This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Having seen my name in a burn book as a kid, I can tell you it's not a good thing. Technically, it's a way of naming and shaming people in your social circle. But most people don't run in the same circles as Kara Swisher. The former tech reporter for The Wall Street Journal is on a massive book tour. Her memoir is titled Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. Her onstage moderators include people she's covered as a journalist. Loreen Powell Jobs, the widow of Apple co-founder Steve Jobs. Bob Iger of Disney. Sam Altman, the current CEO of OpenAI. And while those interviewers wanted to talk to her about her broken relationship with Elon Musk or her views on artificial general intelligence, otherwise known as AGI, I wanted to know how she got to be her. The definitive beat reporter of the consumer internet age with a Google executive for an ex-wife. A journalist turned entrepreneur who co-launched major high-tech and media conferences, All Things D and Code. A podcast star with high-wattage guests. A punchy interviewer who never backs down. And now, an important voice in the public debate over whether and how to regulate tech companies. I'm Audie Cornish, and this is The Assignment. Kara Swisher and I spoke before a live audience of students and professors at the Sine Institute of Policy and Politics at American University. That's where Kara is also a 2024 fellow.
Hi, everybody. How are you? Good morning.
Good morning.
Come on. You don't want to bring this energy to Kara Swisher, okay? Because that's not what you're going to get back. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice.
And that's where we met for this conversation, which I began with an admission. We're friends.
And yeah. I have to say, it made me not want to do this interview with you today.
Okay, all right, good.
Well, because I feel like I'm too close to you to do the interview properly.
Oh, all right, okay.
But I felt like you were then the right person to talk to.
Okay.
Because your whole career is talking to people that you might be a little too close to.
Some of them.
Some of them, yeah.
Yes, that's a good point. So let's go.
The other thing about Kara, which I've told her, is you talk to men the way men talk to women.
Yes. Some men.
Some men.
She
do
said
any
this.
Of you guys know what I'm talking about? When I say that, does that mean something to you?
She said that. She was a guest host on Pivot. We're like, that's exactly what's happening here. And as I thought about it, it was really interesting because I was talking to my wife, Amanda's here also, and she was talking to a man, and I said, this is how you do it. You compliment him. Men aren't used to physical compliments, and you say, that's a nice shirt. So I do that. I do kind of do that a lot. But then if I really want to really get stuff out of them, I actually nag a lot of these men I covered. And I'm like, did you lose weight? Because you were fat last time I saw you, you know, stuff like that. And I realized I came in from San Francisco last night where I did a series of sessions with Reid Hoffman, Sam Altman, Gavin Newsom, and I did it. I was negging them without even trying. And it was really interesting.
So I'm fascinated by this. And I was reading the book looking for your villain origin story, like trying to figure out how you got to be what, you know, as a student, she identified strident, confident. In the book, sometimes you use the word arrogant, talking about yourself even as a young person. And I think that there's something to the fact you're running against a lot of cultural programming as kind of a femme, you know, woman identifying person. You're going to hear a lot about how you should be.
Yes.
And you aren't any of those things.
No, I would say I'm the exact opposite of Katie Britt as her performance last night. I was literally like, she to me in that thing was ChatGPT, show me a Stepford wife in a kitchen, and didn't win the lead role in our town in high school. And so,
because with ChatGPT, you do have to be distinct with the prompts.
Yes, very distinct, actually. So you want to know how I got the way I got?
Well,
yeah. Okay, the origin.
What are your theories?
I think I was born this way because when I was a kid, and again, the names were put on you as a girl, if you were like this. Headstrong is the word they might use. And then later, when I was in school, it was bossy, and it's almost always from men. Not always, but almost always. An interviewer who I competed with quite a bit back in the day and used to beat on a regular basis said I had uncommon confidence, which I found incredibly irritating. And I said to him right when he did it, I was like, uncommon, why? And he was like, well, not everyone's confident. I'm like, why is that unusual? What am I supposed to be, you know, rich, shy and retiring? Am I supposed to be submissive? Like, what is going on here? One, I was like this. Two, may have been about being gay. I knew I was gay at an early age.
Interesting.
And so I didn't feel like I needed to have the approval of men. I think girls get into that quite a bit pretty early. I like men. So I also like men. And so I always got along with men at every stage of my career and teachers and everything else. And then probably my dad dying, I think, made me tougher because you sort of had to be. My dad died when I was 5. And so if I think back on it, really, I really did get steeled during that period. My mom married someone who wasn't very nice. I'm not Cinderella here, but
No. You do the same thing in the book, though, you start to speed past that point of the story.
I do.
I want to know. I mean, you were only 5.
I was five.
We both have kids around that age
That's
correct. And it does bring you back to that place.
It does. And before that, I have older kids, too. And I remember there's two points in my life that were really important when I passed the age my dad died at. That was interesting because I didn't think I'd live past that. So I kind of lived my life in a rush because I thought I would die at that age. I think that's very common among people whose parents die early. My brothers are the same way. We're like
in a rush.
We have no time for this. And then when my son turned, my oldest son, he's 21 now, turned 5, I realized the devastation. I really did. I was like, God, he knows me so well. And you know, you don't have memories. I don't have a lot of memories of my dad. I've always thought I should get hypnotized or something, which I haven't done. But I have little pieces of memories.
Yeah, because that's the age where those images start to be shaped. Right,
but how well does my 4-year-old know me, my 2-year-old? Like, would they remember me? Maybe not. But we have clear relationship every single day, and they're deep. And so the devastation was very clear to me then. I remember being struck when he turned the age I was, because it was clear that I was much more hurt than I realized. But you've covered up pretty quickly. A lot of people whose parents die at a young age become something that Irving Yalom calls highly functional. He was a psychiatrist. He wrote a really good book called The Loss That Is Forever about people whose parents die at a young age. And I do remember that was when I realized how good I was at
moving forward.
I don't think years ago, a friend of mine was in one of those therapies where you talk to someone every day. And we were talking about it. And I was like, what in the world do you find to talk about? Like, I don't have that. I'm not that interesting. Like, what parts of your life could you find? And they turned to me and said they were going to become a therapist because that's why they do it. And I said, I just don't have that much to talk about. I just don't feel like I would have something to talk about every day for hours about myself. And they said, you're blocking. And I said, it's working. Because I'm pretty happy. Like, I was like, where's the depths? And, you know, my wife talks about it a lot. Like, I said, when I met her, I said, I wasn't, neurotic. I said, I don't have any neuroses.
That's not your vibe.
No, it's not. But it really isn't. Either it's there and I've hit it so beautifully, like I'm a mafia don and the cement is deep.
Yeah,
and
the sunglasses
I'm trying to avoid intimacy with you.
Exactly.
I forgot my other glasses.
But it does make me think about this stepdad, because you have this person who comes into your life, but you describe him in extremely specific ways in the book.
Yes.
You use phrases like casually cruel, manipulative. You don't describe him as abusive, so you do feel that now?
Yeah, I do. I do.
Can you describe what it was? Because you were so young. So by the time you're 10, 11, what are these interactions?
It was not physically abusive. It's, you know, everyone always, you know, you tend not to minimize mental abuse, right? Mm-hmm. That I vaguely recall, but I remember this dog was a basset hound named Prudence, and my stepfather got rid of it. It disappeared one day. Can you imagine your dad's dog going and didn't explain it? And when I was slightly older, he made up stories of what he did with it. He's like, oh, I dropped it in the river and all this stuff. It was so cruel.
And are these happening when...
When I'm a
it's
child.
Just kids with him? Is mom around?
Mom's like sort of, around. Yeah. And she let it happen. Yes, she absolutely let it happen. And to be kind to her is she's this young person with three kids and her husband died and she got married pretty quickly. I get it. I get that kind of thing. But she let him do it. She let him do it. He was very, you know, one thing is... He was a game player. He loved strategy games, whatever it was. And so I got very good at like backgammon. But I don't play it. I don't like it. And I'm good at it. It's really weird because it was so aggressive. He taught me in such an aggressive way. And I was also, interestingly, really good at it. Like I actually did have those qualities of a sort of a killer like sense of game playing.
And by the way, we just heard the word killer in the context of backgammon.
Yeah.
So we have an idea of what these games are like.
Yes, you can do, but it is.
Yeah, it's it is.
I must win and dominate. So he did teach me those. He had those qualities, which is a good thing. He had a very strategic mind. And I would say you can learn good things in a bad way, right? And he would do all kinds of things. He bugged our house. He was paranoid. And it was, and we used to find humor in it because my brother and I would always make fake drug deals over the phone. We're like, did you get the pound of hash, you know?
Because you knew he could hear?
Yes.
In that, '80s, '90s way of your parents are listening on the other line?
Yes.
Or he had bugged your phone?
He put bugs, yeah. Like Nixon. He's like Nixon, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So I'm not going to armchair psychiatrist this, but it does, to me, uniquely prepare you for Silicon Valley.
It did.
But also, I
say I'm an optimistic pessimist. I really do think the worst is going to happen. And then when it does, and I'm like, yay, it did.
I know. But it also, you know, you describe a number. I want to talk about some of the people you encountered in the early part of your career. You're a young person.
Yeah.
You're at school. You decide for a variety of reasons as you are kind of cut off from doing what you want to do, right? Mm-hmm. Joining the armed services, specifically the CIA.
That was really a disappointment for me. I wanted to be in the military very much. My dad was in the military. He had just gotten out when he died. He was in the Navy. I wanted to be in the Navy. I have a lot of family members on his side in the Navy, actually. And I really wanted to. I have a great patriotic streak. I have a real belief in America.
But you not doing it is somehow at odds with how I think of you.
Really?
Like, why didn't you just do it?
Because I had to lie. This is even before Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It was you got kicked out and dishonorable discharge. I'm that old. Don't Ask, Don't Tell was another opportunity. And I was like, I ask and I tell. So that's a problem.
You wouldn't be able to do it.
It was so offensive, even more than just kicking people out. That was Clinton. That was a Clinton era thing. That was so offensive to me, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So I couldn't do that. And then years later, when they finally got rid of everything, I wanted to join the reserves, but I was actually too old. So I never got a chance to do it. I thought about joining the CIA. I went to the Foreign Service School. It was a feeder to the CIA and the State Department. Both things, at the time, there was this Clayton Lone Tree scandal. You should look it up. There was all this Russians manipulating Americans that lived in Russia. I didn't even speak Russian, so I don't know why they were so concerned. But when I went for some of the interviews, they were like, you could be blackmailed. I'm like, I'm out. And they were like, but you could be blackmailed. And I was like, but I'm out. It was like these discussions, like they were ridiculous.
Yeah.
But they were very obsessed with gay people at that time. And finding out. And I was like, there's nothing to find out. At one point, they were like, well, what if you went to Saudi Arabia? They kill gay people here. And I'm like, I don't speak Arabic, but okay.
Why would you send me there?
Like,
how did this shape how you think about discrimination, how you think about those
furious.
Kinds of things?
Furious, because it was also the era of the AIDS era. And it was during the Reagan administration. I was in college then. And I was furious about how they treated people with AIDS. And I think a lot of people became activated then.
Yeah.
Gay people were like...
Also, when you face discrimination, I don't know about you, but it makes you feel that identity more acutely.
Yes.
Even if you were strutting around your life.
You.
Yeah,
people
they're telling you,
you
guess wanna... what, you're not out of this box.
Right. And with gay people, you can hide, right? With race and if you're Jewish, you can't hide as easily. And so the two problems, and I'm not going to stack rank anyone's discrimination, but... One is you can hide, but you have to be furtive, which really was terrible. I can't even tell you how terrible that was. And I wasn't good at furtive, and I was very outspoken. And the other thing was your family can dislike you. Like, your family discriminates against you. So it creates this weird thing, and your friends, and people didn't know a lot. It was such a different time. It really was. It's shocking the changes that have happened. But I wanted to have kids, and it was not open to you. That was not something that was open to you. And so I bought a baby, a onesie for my child. I said, I'm having a kid, and I kept it. And he wore it. All the kids wore it. And, it's just it's really hard to be not who you are. And I really was who I was. And I came out pretty quickly. And the AIDS thing was it. I was like, that's f***ing enough. That's enough with you people. People are dying. The Reagan administration was pretending people didn't have AIDS. You remember Rock Hudson, the whole thing. It was such nonsense. And, when things like Angels in America came out, I was like, exactly.
Yeah. But I think it's maybe hard for this generation to understand because they've grown up with activism at their fingertips.
Yes.
Right? Like very young people are running major nonprofits.
Yeah.
That was not coming up. That was...
It's its own set of challenges.
It is.
But for sure, it was hard. It was really hard. And it was... And you didn't have the internet. Like, my ex-wife ran Planet Out, which was one of the first, AOL was one of the first gay communities where people could talk to each other and find each other. I remember Megan, who went on to join Google and then was the CTO of America, she had like 7 members of Planet Out that were from Vatican City, which was really interesting. But they were everywhere. That was the thing. They were people were everywhere and dying to meet each other. So, which is why the online space held such promise for me, especially around gay people. It was real, or people that couldn't meet. Everyone from gay people to one of the first group I encountered was a group of quilters at AOL who had never met. They were just like quilting, and they were sort of alone in their little communities. And then they met online, and they made a giant AOL quilt with each other. And then Steve Case brought them all into to meet each other. They never met. And I remember thinking, this is a magical medium.
You're listening to Kara Swisher. I spoke with her last week at American University. I'll have more after the break.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support. Your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Welcome back. I'm speaking with Kara Swisher about her memoir, Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. It's about her career covering the rise of Silicon Valley's biggest leaders, from Tesla founder Elon Musk, whom she calls her biggest disappointment, to Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff, whom she lists in a chapter called The Mensches.
Why do you think they liked you? Did they see you as one of them?
No. And this was interesting. I don't think that, because I had been, I was at the Wall Street Journal or at the Washington Post first, and they needed me, right? I wasn't an entrepreneur until 10 years later. I didn't leave the safety of the big newspaper until 2002, which was a long time.
Fact that you could call up someone and say, this is what I think you should do. This is what I think you should buy.
I'm going to write this. I would tell them what I was going to do. They often didn't take my advice. I was writing the story of how I thought Google was going to take over Yahoo. And I said to Jerry, these guys are going to eat you. And I said, you should take them off. I didn't think he was going to do it. They never did. They never did what I said.
But do you think they appreciated, again, we talked about how you talk to men. Was mm-hmm. there something about the way you had those conversations? Because now I see an industry that's quite closed.
Yes.
It's very hard to talk to any of them any reason. Mm-hmm. And I think that your stature in the industry and you have the history.
Yes, now I do it in public. Like I had a public argument with Mark Benioff. I was like, Elon's doing this anti-Semitic, this anti-gay, this anti-trans. These are the values you said you held dear. And he goes, well, he can land a rocket on a surfboard. And I was like, I don't understand. So he's a racist who can put a rocket on a surfboard. What I was trying to get out there was like, you should say something. And I said it to him publicly in front of a crowd of 1,000 people. I said, why aren't you saying something publicly? I think you should. If you say you support gay people, this guy just said Paul Pelosi's in a gay love triangle and that's how he got beaten up. Why won't you say anything? And his excuse was, well, he's really innovative. Like we must excuse his sins for that. And so that's what it turned into. When I was at the Journal, I was a beat reporter, right? A beat. You know, and at some point, you have to say, Google bought this. This happened. And the reason I left it was because I got so frustrated at doing an enormous amount of reporting. One particular time was Web Van. And I was like, this ain't going to work. And I wanted to say it in the Wall Street Journal. I wanted to just let that be the way I communicated it. And the editor said, get someone else to say what you think. And you know that, right?
That's very common.
Which is really common. And then they always had a thing in the Journal, they use this term, to be sure, some people say, you know, that kind of thing, which I hate, and I was like, to be sure, some people are idiots. It's not true. And so that's why I started All Things D, because the minute we did All Things D, if you go back, we were like, this is a go rodeo. This is, here's the reporting, here's the scoop, and then let us tell you why it's a go rodeo, because we did the reporting for you.
What I'm interested in is the memoir you use, this analogy of love, mm-hmm. you know?
Yes.
And love clouds your judgment.
It does. It can. It can. But I love the tech, not the people. I love the possibilities of technology. I really did believe, and it probably was from being gay now that I think about it, it's like we can come out and meet each other now.
Red flags that you missed? Industry-wise, in terms of how culture was changing?
No, because I think we were on that a lot earlier when Google, I wrote a particular tough piece on Google about their need to be the Borg and take over everything. We wrote that in...
The antithesis of don't be evil.
No, right? Yes, right, exactly. So we wrote a lot of those in 2001, 2002, saying this company is starting to turn into Microsoft. And they got mad at me for doing that. And we were saying, if they do that, they will have unlimited power because this is where advertising is going and everything else. We were super tough on Yahoo's mistakes, Twitter, Uber. I think we helped get Travis Kalanick fired over that. That was later. That was in the 2000s.
There's a way that given when you started covering it and where you are now, that your experience kind of mirrors our own cultural
That's correct.
Experience yeah. of
yes,
the industry.
Yes, which I was trying to get at.
Yeah, good. But so I did the homework.
Here's what I pushed
But just
back.
It goes from grandiose utopia.
I was not a fanboy. I definitely was not those
But
people.
We all were, right? Like we
no,
were.
No.
I do think that we were sold, not a bill of goods, but definitely there was a reverence for young tech leadership. They were bringing
100%.
Us something. We were not talking about them like they were robber barons or railroad guys. Okay,
no.
It was very
no.
different.
No.
Whereas now, people do see them as insular,
That's correct.
Reckless,
That's correct.
Self-aggrandizing
mm-hmm.
billionaires.
Yes.
And I do feel like that is a shift.
But I don't think people heard it. We did an interview with Mark Zuckerberg where we ran over him so much that he almost sweat to death.
Infamous
right?
flop sweat.
Right.
Yeah. And the social network did that.
Yes, we had been pressing him about privacy and the Beacon. We were particularly tough about Beacon. And we're like, what are you doing? This is worse. Even Steve Case, at one point when he was collecting all this information, we were talking about the hacking, the possibilities of hacking it. And he was at one investor meeting and he was bragging about how he made $63 each person, right? 63. I mean, that's what the data that they got, that they that you cost
Because we're
to
the
him.
Product.
That's correct. And I raised my hand and I said, where's my $30? Like, why are you taking my things? And I think one of the problems that it led to is this sort of which Scott Galloway calls the idolatry of innovators. And I think that's true.
We're in this strange moment now with generative
AI.
Artificial intelligence, AI, and You were recently talking to Sam Altman, who, you
yesterday,
know,
last night, 12 hours ago. Yeah.
But you also said there needs to be a certain kind of personality in this next generation.
There does. There also needs to be an aggressive person, too.
Like you said, contemplative also,
right? He is much more so.
And this is not to pick on him in particular, but I feel like AI is being greeted with far more skepticism.
Yeah.
In some corners, 100%. Panic.
A panic.
It's a very different...
Well, that's because it's science fiction, but go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. But it's a very different, like, this is going to be so cool. We're going to get to do... But it's much more like, whoa.
Yes.
Are the robots going to kill us all?
Yes.
And what are the lessons that you take from the last couple years of reporting into this next phase?
It's interesting because I'm in the middle. I'm like Dr. Fei-Fei Li. I'm in the middle. I'm like, and people are surprised. They're like, don't you want to stop this? I'm like, we could solve cancer. No, I don't. Like, again, I don't think I'm too hopeful because I'm very aware of the dangers. I think what's good about this year is the actual makers of these things are contemplating the dangers of them. And honestly, the first person who talked about it was me 10, 15 years ago was Elon Musk. Was very worried about that. He was sort of deep in the sci-fi part of it, and it shifted a little bit over time. At first, it was Terminator. It was the Terminator. This is it. And then it became, well, treat us like house cats. And then it was like, oh, it's really like you're a builder and you go over an anthill, and if you kill it, you don't think about it. Like, it became that, which I think is probably more accurate. It'll only do what we tell it to do, right?
But how should reporters approach this now based on what you went through those early years?
I am making a heavy pressure on regulators right now. I spent a lot of time texting regulators saying, what the f*** are you doing?
Do you think people didn't do that enough in the past, not you, broader tech press?
Yes, I think it was, it is an astonishing thing to think about the most powerful companies in the world and the richest people in the world, in the history of the world, not having any regulation applied to them. And the regulation that applies to them is advantageous, which is Section 230. It's really unusual for the richest people in the world not to be able to be sued at all. Like, really, pretty much. Not everybody.
Yeah. Because again, we've talked about this in Congress. Mm-hmm. It's not like banking regulations where there's a constituency of lawmakers who want to do more regulations and the banks push back, but there's a push-pull.
Yes. Well, there are regulations, even
with
if they're...
With tech, it's often like, we don't want to squash innovation.
Right, that's what they do.
And then silence.
Silence, right. We won't squash innovation. And so that's been their excuse, is we don't want to... And honestly, I think what squashed innovation is our reliance on them to self-regulate and therefore disaster after disaster. And so...
Are we headed in the same direction?
I compared it a couple of years ago in the New York Times. I compared Mark Zuckerberg. He's like, he's got a butcher shop and he's like, some of the meat is probably going to kill you, but I don't know what, which one. But it's not my responsibility to worry about the rancid meat. You're just going to have to, good luck, that kind of thing. And he got mad at that. But I felt like that was a good thing. But to me, ultimately, now... This guy just wants to make money. And that's why the first line of the book is, so was capitalism after all. And I think that our regulators are now on the hook because these people are here for the shareholders.
But they look outmatched, frankly.
They
look at a Sam Altman and I just think, I don't know a single lawmaker that is going to get to toe-to-toe with this person, much less be toe-to-toe with them.
Well, that's the thing. It's astonishing to think the federal government does not have enough power. And they don't. They really don't. I mean, these people have... I jokingly said, I was around some Facebook people, I was like, what are there, like 80 PR people just on me? And they're like, no, 40. And I was like, oh,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
But like, Joe Biden in his State of the Union, the president talked about trying to do regulations, I think specifically against voice imitation AI.
Yes, deepfakes, yeah. Well, that's because he got God. He got God. They did all these things with him.
Is that a moment for someone to...
There have all been moments. You know, when there was a moment, the insurrection. Like, look, it was one of the best pieces I wrote is in 2019. I wrote a column in the New York Times. My first column in the New York Times in 2017, I called them digital arms dealers. That's why I did that column, because I wanted to alert public officials to what was happening. And so I said, these people are really hurting us. I wrote a column before COVID saying they're going to have more power than ever after COVID because we're going to have to rely on them so much. And then they'll be richer and they'll be trillion-dollar companies and then we can't stop them. But during 2019, I had argued with Mark about Alex Jones. He moved into Holocaust analysis. I was worried about anti-Semitism. That was a very famous interview where he said Holocaust deniers don't mean to lie, and he wasn't going to take them off this platform. And I said, you are going to reap the rewards of what you're doing here in a very bad way. But the column I wrote was saying, when he loses in 2020, he's going to say it was stolen, and then he's going to make sure he says it over and over again. He's going to radicalize his people. It's going to go up and down the right-wing echo chamber. It's all over the place, the right-wing echo chamber.
I just worry that you've told us a story about people who rise to power virtually unchecked.
Yes.
And once they get there, don't want any unchecked kind of accountability.
They don't.
You and I have talked about how hard it is for lawmakers to get it together. Mm-hmm. And now we're staring down this dark tunnel of AI.
This is the most important computing change in the generation.
And you've moved to Washington.
Yes.
To talk more about regulation.
Yeah.
Are there willing ears? Is there, a constituency in all of us? Do we care enough, or is it more convenient for us to like order food and helicopters or whatever in the apps than to actually deal with this? Because I don't want to be in a love story with flames on it 10 years from
right,
now. You know what I mean? Like, I would like to get this.
Haven't we all?
I would like to get it right, so to speak.
Well, here's the problem, because it's already inbuilt. There's the lobbying is astonishing. There is a feeling by, you know, you saw those parents face Mark Zuckerberg the other day.
Right, in the congressional
hearings.
There is a,
like, what are you doing? But even that wasn't enough. He didn't apologize. He said, I'm sorry for what happened to you. That is not an apology, as far as I can understand it. And I saw his eyes, and he was quite upset. He's a person. I know he doesn't seem like one, but he is. And I think one of the problems is it's always pushback. And by the way, it's not just Republicans who are just spend their time just cosplaying, like TikTok, let's get them. Like, that's not our biggest problem. It is a problem.
But we are exactly going through this fight on Capitol Hill right now about TikTok.
But guess what? It is a problem. I wrote about it 5 years ago. But what we really need is basic things. Artificial general intelligence safety regulation. A privacy bill would be nice. This 10, 20 years into it, a national privacy bill, a data transparency bill, an algorithmic transparency bill. Like, there's 10 of them. I wrote a story a long time ago called the Internet Bill of Rights and named the 10.
We should say the EU, the European Union, has
acted.
Started to act and make more regulations. Why do you think they are able to do it in a way that the U.S. can't?
Because they don't get the benefits from these companies that our country does, right? These are U.S. companies. The financial benefits. They aren't getting the benefits. They're getting a lot of the negatives. Their governments aren't bought and paid for by these tech companies. And so they're not under as much pressure. And so Marguerite Vestager, I'm actually talking to her next week, is able to put these fines on, and she's not getting pushback. And it's a much more privacy-oriented world over there in Europe. It just is.
Are you in your activist era?
No, I think I have been. If you go back,
But this is different. Moving to Washington, you're burning the relationships.
Yes.
Not that hard, because they're like all on the book tour, but you're speaking more publicly. And you're speaking more publicly.
No, only the people I like are on the book tour. Elon and I are not going to be doing appearance together.
That's fair, but you trust Altman more than I do right now. That way.
Well, it's a low bar. It's a low bar. If I can impact him, sure. I want to impact him. I did say to him last night.
Do you see that? That's why I'm asking. Do you see that also now as part of your work?
Yes. I said to him, I have great hopes that you'll try to at least do. I know it's a big money-making thing for all of you, and you're already a billionaire, so I suppose you have enough money. But I said, if you start down the ugly road of Elon Musk, I am going to turf you. I think I said that to him. I'm going to turf you. I'm going to try to turf you. At least, kind of thing. So yeah,
does turf you mean?
Put you down.
Oh, okay.
Put you down. Like, don't get up. Don't get up. That kind of thing. But my idea is, I'm watching you, and I'm hoping for the best from these people. And look, there's a lot of entrepreneurs that are doing climate change.
You're hoping for the best, but you're ready to take them down for the worst.
Yes, and I think what they're by nature, because the money involved is so big, it's so massive, they're gonna want to advantage shareholders. That's what they do. That's what they do. But in doing this, I'm hoping that some of them, and I would say you can find people who do understand the gravity of the situation, like a Satya Nadella at Microsoft. It's not activists. It's more, you know, speaking of CNN, I think Christiane Amanpour, I really like that saying, truthful, not neutral. I'm not neutral about this. And I think this new era, if Trump wins, he understands the uses of online to manipulate and quash people. And so I see, like, this could go real bad, real fast. And that's the whole point that I'm trying to make, which I did, I think, with the Star Trek, Star Wars metaphor, which is we could go Star Trek, which is good, or we could go Star Wars, which is bad. But it's not the tech that's the problem. It's the people manipulating the tech. So I guess you could say I'm an activist. I'm an activist for unaccountable power not being unaccountable, and that we should not have private companies running space. Government people should be involved, and so should citizens. We should not have giant companies control AGI, and that's what they're doing right now. So if I keep saying, hey, big companies are controlling AGI, government, what are you going to do about it? Enough times that someone will listen, and they will also listen because they think the people that can do something about it are listening to me, which is often the case, right? That happens a lot.
Kara Swisher.
Thank you so
much. Amazing.
Wonderful.
Kara Swisher is the host of the podcast On with Kara Swisher and Pivot with her co-host Scott Galloway. Her new memoir is called Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. We spoke at American University in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to director Amy Dacey and everyone at the Sign Institute who made us feel so welcome. That's all for today. We'll be back with a new politics episode on Monday. The Assignment is a production of CNN Audio. This episode was produced by Dan Bloom. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. Our engineer is Michael Hammond. Dan DeZula is our technical director. And Steve Lichtai is the executive producer of CNN Audio. We got support from Haley Thomas, Alex Manisseri, Robert Mathers, John Dionora, Lenny Steinhardt, Jameis Andrus, Nicole Pesaru, and Lisa Namorow. Special thanks to Katie Hinman. I'm Audie Cornish, and thank you for listening.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.